When you look down at a really sprawling city from an airplane at night, what instantly captures your attention are the lights.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, human eye is just naturally drawn to all that movement.
Right. You see the bright, the flashing neons downtown or the headlights zipping down the highways.
Yeah.
And it's this incredibly mesmerizing display.
It really is.
But, it's so easy to look at all that fast-moving electricity and just think to yourself, like, that right there, that is the city.
Which is a huge mistake, honestly.
Exactly. Because if you only focus on those lights, you're completely ignoring the massive invisible infrastructure that actually makes the city exist.
Right, the stuff you can't see from the plane.
Yeah, like the thousands of tons of concrete foundations, right? Or the subterranean water mains, the zoning laws, the underlying power grid itself. You miss the structural reality that dictates, where those cars are even allowed to drive.
Which, I have to say, serves as just a remarkable parallel for what might be the single largest scientific blind spot in, well, maybe the entire history of human biology.
Yeah, and welcome to this deep dive, by the way. Because if you've ever looked at a biological model of the brain or, just thought about your own mind and felt totally overwhelmed by the mystery of how this clump of wet tissue produces your rich inner world, get ready.
Yeah, we have a really fascinating stack of sources today.
We really do. Today's deep dive is going to offer a huge aha moment. We're pulling from MIT computational research, deep evolutionary biology papers, some recent features from Quantum Magazine and Science Daily, and we're exploring a massive paradigm shift.
A total upending of the dogma.
Right, we're diving into the astrocentric hypothesis. Basically, this is the argument that a specific type of overlooked star-shaped cell, the astrocyte, is actually the primary computational unit of the brain.
Not the neuron, which is what we've been told forever.
Exactly. We're going to explore why these silent cells offer far better explanations for how you remember and think than the traditional neuron-only models ever could. So let's unpack this.
Let's do it. And to really grasp this, we have to start with the sheer numbers, because the cellular census of your own head is kind of shocking.
Yeah, break that down for us, because I think a lot of people just assume the brain is made entirely of neurons.
Right, and that's the foundation of this whole misunderstanding. It's a miscalculation based on volume. We've spent an entire century idolizing neurons, the cells with those long wire-like axons that fire those famous electrical spikes.
The ones that light up in all the textbook diagrams.
Exactly. But neurons make up only about 15% of the total cells in the human brain.
Wait, just 15%?
Just 15. The remaining vast majority, the other 85%, belongs to this category of cells known collectively as glia.
Glia, which, if I'm remembering my Greek roots correctly, literally translates to glue.
Yes. They named 85% of the human brain after stationary paste.
That is wild. They named almost the entire brain after glue.
They did. And that naming convention wasn't just some quirky historical footnote. It fundamentally dictated how these cells were treated by the scientific community for generations.
Like they just dismissed them.
Completely. They were dismissed as the brain's packing peanuts. The prevailing assumption was that glia were merely cellular housekeepers.
Just there to sweep up.
Yeah, incredibly menial jobs. Hold the important neurons in place, sweep up the metabolic waste after a neuron fires, maybe buffer some stray ions. Neuroscience basically treated neurons as the brilliant directors of the cognitive show, while glia were just the stagehands.
Wow. But to understand how we ended up with such a heavily skewed perspective, I mean, we have to look back at the reigning champion of brain science, which is the neuron doctrine.
Right, going all the way back to Santiago Ramón y Cajal.
Yeah, the legendary neuroanatomist. And that doctrine basically states that all information processing in the brain is just discrete electrical impulses, action potentials.
Zipping along neural networks, jumping across tiny gaps.
Right. And that electrical dance is supposedly the sum total of thought. Under that model, I guess it makes sense why you'd ignore the glue. But how did we get it so fundamentally wrong for so long?
Well, what's fascinating here is that our theoretical understanding was completely trapped by the physical limitations of our tools.
How so?
Well, to study the brain back in the early and mid-20th century, scientists relied heavily on electrophysiology. They used microelectrodes, which are essentially incredibly tiny, highly sensitive microphones for electricity,
Okay.
and they inserted these into brain tissue to listen to what was happening. Now, those microelectrodes are brilliant at detecting rapid millisecond scale electrical spikes.
Which is the language of the neurons.
Exactly. That's the exact language of neurons.
So they basically built a tool designed to listen to a very specific frequency, and
yeah,
surprise, surprise, that's the only frequency they heard.
Exactly the problem. These tools were completely deaf to the language of astrocytes, because astrocytes, they don't use rapid-fire electrical action potentials for their primary communication.
What do they use instead?
They use a much slower, chemically driven signaling method. So if you're only listening for a sharp electrical pop, a slow, swelling chemical wave is going to pass right by your sensor, completely undetected.
It's like, okay, it's like trying to understand how a massive global corporation works by only tracking the instant text messages sent between the sales team.
Oh, that's a great analogy. Yeah.
Right. Like the sales team, the neurons are firing off these rapid texts like sale closed or call this client. And because you only have the software to read text messages, you completely ignore the detailed, long-term strategic emails sent by upper management.
The astrocytes.
Yeah, the astrocytes. And then you write a whole textbook claiming the sales team runs the entire company just because they're the only ones you can hear talking.
And if we push that corporate metaphor a bit further, upper management was always there. They were shaping the company's direction, adjusting the budgets. We just didn't have the password to their email server until, well, really the late 1980s.
Wait, the late 80s? That recently?
Yeah. 1989 specifically, there was a researcher named Steve Finkbeiner working in Stephen Smith's laboratory at Yale.
And from what I read in the sources, he wasn't even setting out to study astrocyte communication, right?
Not at all. It was pure serendipity. He just had a bed of astrocytes in his petri dish, acting as a literal nutrient layer, just keeping his precious neurons alive.
Just acting as the dirt for his plants, basically.
Pretty much. And he was using a new type of advanced imaging technique, a confocal microscope with special fluorescent dyes that light up when they bind to calcium. So he decides to apply glutamate to the dish.
And glutamate is, it's an excitatory neurotransmitter, right?
Yes, one of the most common ones. It's the chemical neurons used to shout at each other to fire. So he expected the neurons to react. But suddenly, the background layer, the packing peanuts, reacted in a way no one had ever seen.
The quote from the source material is that the astrocytes went completely nuts, which I just love for a scientific breakthrough.
It's very accurate, actually.
But what did that physically look like through the microscope?
Well, through the lens, these fluorescent dyes illuminated a massive coordinated wave of calcium rippling across the entire bed of astrocytes.
Wow.
Imagine a drop of water hitting a still pond and the ripple spreading out in perfect concentric circles. But inside living tissue, it wasn't a sudden electrical spike. It was this slow, majestic, brilliantly glowing wave of calcium hopping from the inside of one astrocyte to the next.
So they were actively communicating.
Undeniably. They were listening to the glutamate, the exact same neurotransmitter the neurons were using, and responding with their own massive secondary communication network.
Okay, so we finally see these calcium waves. We realize the glue is actually gossiping behind the neurons' backs. But couldn't the hardcore neuron doctrine defenders just say, fine, the glue talks to itself, but the neurons are still doing the actual computing?
They certainly tried to argue that for a while, but this is really where the house of cards begins to fall. We're currently living in this era of neuroscience that is just obsessed with connectomics.
Connectomics, mapping the connections.
Right. It's this incredibly well-funded idea that if we can just map every single physical wire, every single synaptic connection between every neuron, we'll have the ultimate blueprint of the brain.
Like a literal wiring diagram.
Exactly. But researchers like Mark Freeman, who is heavily highlighted in our materials, have pointed out that connectomics is fundamentally insufficient.
Why is that?
Because you can take a neural circuit, observe it firing in a very specific pattern, and then watch that firing pattern change completely, producing a totally different output. But if you look at the physical wiring, the connectome, it hasn't changed at all.
Wait, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. The physical wiring, the hardware of the circuit, stays exactly the same, but the software output changes entirely.
Zero changes in connectivity, totally different result.
How is that even possible if the neurons are the only things doing the computing?
It's impossible under a neuron-only model. The only way to explain it is to acknowledge those unseen managers. Behind the scenes, the astrocytes are acting as master modulators.
So they're tweaking things without unplugging the wires.
Exactly. They drape themselves over those neural connections, listen to the network activity, and actively dial the strength of those synapses up or down. They can mute a connection or amplify it without adding a single new wire.
So if you're only looking at the wiring diagram, you're getting a completely misleading picture of what the circuit can actually do.
An incredibly incomplete picture, yes.
Wow. Okay, so astrocytes are communicating via massive calcium waves, and they're controlling the circuits. But to really grasp why they're so vital for us, for human beings specifically, we need to take a massive step back, right?
We do. We need to look at the evolution.
Because the question that's always bothered me, and probably anyone who thinks about animal intelligence, is what I'd call the elephant problem.
The brain size issue.
Yeah. An elephant's brain is physically much, much larger than a human's. A whale's is even bigger. If intelligence is just about having a bigger brain with more neurons, elephants should be the ones recording this deep dive.
Right, and this is where the evolutionary biology from our sources gets truly mind-bending. Because the causal chain of human intelligence actually starts with astrophysics.
Astrophysics, come on.
Seriously, the evolution of mammalian high-level cognition is bizarrely tied to deep geological and cosmic events. We're talking about tectonic shifts on Earth that were driven by radioactive decay deep in the planet's core.
Okay.
And the isotopes driving that geothermal heat were forged in ancient cosmic events, like binary neutron star mergers generating gravitational waves way out in the cosmos.
I am going to need you to connect the dots between two colliding stars in deep space and the fact that I can, you know, do algebra. Because that is a massive leap.
It sounds like pure sci-fi, but the causal chain is remarkably clear. That geothermal heat drove plate tectonics over millions of years, and this tectonic movement eventually led to the formation of the Panama Isthmus about 3 million years ago.
Which closed the seaway between North and South America.
Precisely. And when you close a major ocean gateway like that, you drastically alter global ocean currents. This triggered cascading climate shifts across the globe, specifically causing the intense drying of the African continent.
Ah, which turned the lush forests into open savannas.
Exactly, the environmental pressure needed. The hominids living there were forced out of the receding trees and had to adapt to a much more complex, dangerous savanna environment.
So they couldn't just climb away from predators anymore.
Right. This sudden evolutionary pressure heavily favored encephalization, which is the rapid, disproportionate growth of the brain relative to body size. You had to outsmart the predators.
But growing a bigger brain is incredibly expensive, biologically speaking, right? It's not like just growing a slightly longer arm. The brain is an energy hog.
Staggering metabolic costs. Just to give you context, your brain right now makes up only about 2% of your total body mass. But it demands roughly 20% of your body's total glucose utilization and oxygen intake.
Wow. 20% for just 2% of the mass.
It is a furnace. And as these early hominid brains grew, the neurons developed these massive dendritic trees to receive signals and incredibly long axons to connect distant areas. Firing rapid electrical signals down those long wires requires intense, continuous metabolic support.
So the neurons couldn't just scale up on their own. Like, if the sales team triples in size and expands globally, you can't just leave the same three IT guys in the basement and expect the company to function.
You need a massive upgrade in support infrastructure. And this necessity led to a disproportionate increase in the ratio of glia to neurons.
So as the brain gets bigger, we get way more glia.
Dramatically more. To support this energy drain, certain genes had to work overtime. The sources highlight genes involved in energy metabolism, specifically one called CA2, which was heavily upregulated in the human cortex.
Just to manage the demand.
Yes. But here is the critical pivot in the evolutionary story. It wasn't just that humans got more astrocytes to feed the extra neurons. Human astrocytes evolved into something fundamentally structurally different.
Okay, this is the leap.
Right. It's known in the field as the Oberheim or Niedergaard paradox.
So what does this actually mean for you, the listener, sitting there with a human brain?
Yeah.
If you picture a mouse brain and compare it to yours, the intuitive thought is just scale. We just have a supersized mouse brain.
But the paradox tells us the building blocks themselves underwent a radical redesign.
A complete overhaul.
Yeah. In 2009, a researcher named Nancy Ann Oberheim and her colleagues at the Niedergaard Lab conducted this comparative study that just shattered the assumption of simple scaling.
What do they do?
They took human astrocytes, often obtained from tissue removed during neurosurgeries, and compared them side by side with rodent astrocytes. And they found that human protoplasmic astrocytes aren't just a little bigger. They represent a massive evolutionary leap.
How big are we talking?
Human astrocytes are about 2.6 times larger in diameter, measuring roughly 143 to 150 micrometers across.
Which I assume, in the microscopic cellular world, is an absolute behemoth.
It is gigantic, but it's not just the sheer size, it's the complexity. These human astrocytes have 10 times more primary processes or main branches extending from their center compared to a rodent's.
10 times more branches.
They look like incredibly dense, complex tumbleweeds of biological matter.
Reaching out into the neural tissue.
Yeah.
And we established earlier that they communicate via those glowing calcium waves. Does that internal communication network speed up with the size?
It actually outpaces the size increase, those slow calcium waves. In human astrocytes, they travel 4 times faster than they do in rodents.
4 times faster.
Yeah, 36 micrometers per second in a human compared to just 9 in a mouse. But it goes even further than that. The human neocortex harbors entirely unique subtypes of astrocytes that do not even exist in the rodent brain.
New models of the cell entirely. What do they do?
We have what are called interlaminar astrocytes. They sit in the superficial top layers of our cortex, but they send these incredibly long millimeter-length fibers plunging straight down into the deeper layers.
Like a high-speed elevator between floors.
Exactly. And we also have varicose projection astrocytes in the deeper layers, sending long-range communication lines across different cortical columns. These seem to be unique to higher-order primates and humans.
Okay, I want to ground this anatomical description in a number from the research that genuinely forced me to put the paper down and just, like, stare at the wall for a minute.
I know exactly the number you're talking about.
It's crazy. If we take a standard rodent astrocyte, it reaches out and physically connects to maybe 20,000 to 120,000 individual synapses.
Right, the tiny junctions where neurons talk to each other.
Which is a lot of connections for a mouse. But a human astrocyte, how many synapses does one single human astrocyte physically touch, monitor, and control?
Prepare yourself. A single human astrocyte can envelop and actively regulate between 270,000 and 2 million synapses simultaneously.
2 million. One single cell is managing the conversations of 2 million different neural connections at the exact same time.
And this is the answer to the elephant problem. The computational power of the cortex does not increase simply because we have a higher raw count of neurons. It increases exponentially as a function of the size and complexity of these astrocytic domains.
So the dense, massive scale of astrocyte integration is the hardware upgrade.
Exactly. That's what gives humans vastly superior cognitive abilities compared to animals with much larger absolute brain volumes. The secret isn't just having more electrical wires, it's the unfathomable processing power of our upgraded astrocytes managing those wires.
Okay, so we've established this awe-inspiring macro-level scale, but I want to zoom all the way back into the micro-level, because saying a cell manages 2 million synapses is pretty abstract. How does a single astrocyte actually control a synapse to dictate how an animal behaves?
To understand the mechanics there, we basically have to throw out the old textbook drawing of a synapse.
The one from high school biology.
Exactly. The drawing of the bipartite synapse. It shows two neurons, a sending neuron ending in a little bulb, an empty gap called the synaptic cleft, and a receiving neuron catching the transmitters.
Right, the classic two-part system. Sender, gap, receiver.
That image is totally obsolete. The biological reality is the tripartite synapse.
Tripartite, three parts.
Right. Imagine those same two neurons, but now wrap that entire junction completely in the tiny, microscopic, finger-like extensions of an astrocyte.
Like it's holding hands with both of them.
More like engulfing them. These fine branches are called parasynaptic astrocytic processes, or PPs. The astrocyte creates a closed, highly controlled microenvironment around that gap. It actively listens to the neurotransmitters being passed, but more importantly, it talks back.
How does it talk back? What's its chemical language?
Through a process called gliotransmission, astrocytes release their own potent chemical messengers directly into that enclosed synapse, things like ATP, GABA, and glutamate. But crucially, they release a very specific, unique molecule called D-serine. And D-serine is the perfect example of astrocytic control.
Why is D-serine so special?
Because on the receiving neuron, there are specific receptors called NMDA receptors. These are absolutely vital for neuroplasticity and learning. If they don't activate, the circuit can't change and you can't learn anything.
And the neurons can't activate those learning receptors on their own.
They physically cannot. The NMDA receptor is essentially a locked door that requires two different keys to open simultaneously. The sending neuron provides the first key, glutamate.
Okay.
But the lock will not turn unless the astrocyte is there, actively providing the second key, which is D-serine. The astrocyte holds the literal biological key to the neuron's ability to learn.
So, the astrocyte is like the bouncer at an incredibly exclusive club.
I like that.
Right. The sending neurons are standing outside the velvet rope, shouting, waving their glutamate, trying to get the party started inside the receiving neuron. But the door does not open unless the astrocytic bouncer checks the vibe and hands over the D-serine.
And if we push that analogy to match the scale we just discussed, that single human astrocyte is managing the velvet ropes for 2 million separate VIP rooms simultaneously.
Wow.
Because it covers so many synapses, it tracks the aggregate activity of the entire neural neighborhood. It senses when the network is too excited or too quiet and releases chemicals to suddenly change the brain's overall state.
Which researchers call behavioral state switching, right?
Yes.
And the sources mentioned this deeply fascinating, honestly very relatable study published in Quantum magazine that perfectly illustrates this state switching. It involves zebrafish.
The futility study.
Yes. Researchers were trying to understand the biology of giving up. They put these zebrafish in a tank where they had to swim against a current, but they rigged the current, so it was mathematically impossible for the fish to make any forward progress.
Right.
And eventually, the fish transitioned from a state of active hope and struggle to a state of absolute hopelessness. They just stopped swimming and let the current take them.
And the traditional neurocentric assumption for a very long time was that this shift was simply neuronal fatigue. The motor neurons driving the tail muscles just ran out of energy, got tired, and stopped firing.
Which sounds completely logical. You swim too hard, your muscles and nerves get tired.
Yeah.
But that is not what the researchers found at all, is it?
Not even close. By using advanced imaging to monitor the fish's brain while it struggled, they discovered an entirely different mechanism. With every single futile attempt the fish made to swim forward, the neurons would fire, and the local astrocytes would detect that firing.
Okay.
And with each failure, the astrocytes accumulated a tiny bit of internal calcium. They were literally keeping a biochemical tally of the fish's failures.
They were keeping score.
Yes. And once that internal calcium reached a specific critical threshold, the astrocytes took action. They released a massive wave of ATP into the extracellular space.
And what does the ATP do?
It rapidly converts into another chemical called adenosine. And adenosine specifically binds to the motor neurons and actively suppresses them. It forces them to start firing.
So the neurons weren't too tired to swim?
No. The astrocytes did the math on the futility of the situation and actively initiated a chemical shutdown. They effectively said, this behavior is a waste of metabolic resources. Shut it down.
And the most incredible part of that study, the part that really proves who is in charge, is what happened next.
Right.
The researchers use a highly targeted laser to ablate or temporarily disable those specific scorekeeping astrocytes in a new group of fish.
This part is wild.
Yeah, when they put those fish back into the impossible current, the fish literally never gave up. They swam and swam, completely unable to transition into that passive state until they physically exhausted themselves to the point of death. The behavioral switch was entirely reliant on the astrocyte.
And what's truly compelling is that this mechanism isn't isolated to zebrafish. We see parallel astrocytic control mechanisms across vastly different species.
Like the fruit flies.
Yes, take fruit flies. Researchers investigated the startle response, how a fly instantly transitions from a resting state to a state of high alert. This involves a neuromodulator called norepinephrine, which is heavily associated with arousal and attention in humans, too.
Right, the adrenaline rush.
Exactly. They found that when a fly is startled, a wash of norepinephrine hits the brain. But it doesn't primarily act on the neurons to wake them up. It acts directly on the astrocytes.
Wow.
The norepinephrine binds to the astrocyte, suddenly alters its internal chemistry, and allows it to instantly listen to a much wider range of neurotransmitters. It wakes the astrocyte up, which then rapidly rewires the entire neural network to prioritize escape behaviors.
So the arousal chemical wakes up the manager, and the manager immediately redirects the sales team to handle the crisis.
Perfect analogy.
And there was a mouse study highlighted in the text, too, looking specifically at neuroplasticity, the physical changing of circuits that allows for learning.
Yes. The groundbreaking work of Thomas Papoyan and his team. They were also looking at norepinephrine and how it drives synaptic plasticity in mice.
Okay.
The neurocentric dogma dictated that norepinephrine caused these learning changes by binding to receptors directly on the neurons. So to test this, Papoyan's team used genetic engineering to completely remove the norepinephrine receptors from the neurons. They left them only on the astrocytes.
So if the dogma was right, the learning should stop immediately because the neurons can't hear the signal.
Exactly, but it didn't. The neural circuits still exhibited robust plasticity. The physical changes required for learning were found to be mediated entirely by the astrocytes reacting to the norepinephrine and then instructing the neurons on how to change.
So the neurons were merely the physical medium being manipulated.
Yes. The astrocytes were the architects of the plasticity.
Okay, I do have to push back here for a second. On behalf of the listener who might be scientifically inclined or maybe remembers reading a conflicting headline a few years ago, because the sources do not shy away from the fact that this was fiercely debated. The text specifically names Fiacco and McCarthy, who were prominent skeptics.
They were very vocal, yes.
They published papers arguing that gliotransmission wasn't a real physiological phenomenon in a natural living brain.
Right.
They ran an experiment where they genetically knocked out a specific receptor in astrocytes called the IP3R2 receptor.
Right.
And this receptor is known to be responsible for releasing those big calcium waves from the main body of the astrocyte. So they knocked it out, effectively breaking the astrocyte's main calcium mechanism.
And they found that the mice could still navigate mazes and learn just fine.
Exactly. Their conclusion was basically, look, we broke the astrocyte's ability to communicate, and the brain's memory works perfectly. Therefore, astrocytes are not driving the bus. The neurons are doing it all.
That was indeed a massive, highly contentious debate in the field, and it caused a lot of confusion for several years.
I can imagine.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture of how tools dictate our understanding, those early doubts were based on a fundamentally flawed assumption about astrocytic anatomy.
How so?
Well, the skeptics successfully knocked out the IP3R2 receptor, and they were right that this receptor controls the massive global calcium waves that originate from the central cell body, the soma of the astrocyte.
Like the main switchboard.
Yes. But what they didn't realize, because imaging technology wasn't quite fast or precise enough yet to see it, is that astrocytes have multiple highly localized ways to elevate calcium. They don't just rely on the main switchboard.
Ooh.
Out in the incredibly tiny distant microdomains, the very tips of those parasynaptic branches wrapping around the millions of synapses, the astrocyte has local, independent mechanisms for generating calcium spikes.
Wait, so even though the central power plant of the cell was shut down by the genetic knockout, the local branches were still operating perfectly fine on their own little microgenerators?
Exactly that. They completely bypassed the central cell body. The local branches were still actively listening to the synapses and releasing D-serine and APP, so the mice could still learn because the local gliotransmission was never actually broken in the first place.
Wow, so the test itself was flawed.
Right. Once researchers developed the technology to visualize these tiny localized calcium sparks in the microdomains, the Fiacco and McCarthy debate was largely settled. The behavioral studies decisively proved that when you actually monitor these specific local astrocytic signals in a living animal, the astrocytes are absolutely dictating state switching and learning.
Here is where it gets really interesting. We've established that astrocytes are controlling the local behavior, deciding in real time when a single synapse gets stronger or weaker. But how does this micromanagement relate to our big long-term memories?
The things that define our identities.
Exactly. Because if there's one thing the old neuron-only model notoriously struggles with, it's the sheer size of the human brain's hard drive.
This is known as the memory capacity problem, and it is a massive thorn in the side of neurocentric theories. Under traditional computational models of the brain-like hot field networks, which model how neurons wire together to store patterns, there is a strict mathematical limit on how much information a network can hold.
Right.
In a purely neuron-to-neuron network where one wire connects to one other wire, the storage capacity scales linearly with the number of neurons.
Meaning if you add 10 neurons, you get 10 units of storage.
Yeah.
Add a million, get a million units. It's a one-to-one growth rate.
Yes. And the problem is that the human brain holds a massive, almost incomprehensible amount of associative information over a lifetime. You remember the smell of your grandmother's house, the lyrics to a song you haven't heard in 20 years, complex physical skills.
So the math just doesn't work out.
Mathematically speaking, you simply cannot explain human memory capacity using a linearly scaling network of neurons. We should run out of storage space incredibly quickly.
So how do astrocytes step in and solve the math problem?
Researchers at MIT proposed a brilliant new computational architecture called dense associative memory, or DENSEM. This directly incorporates the physical reality of the astrocyte we discussed earlier.
The ones touching millions of synapses.
Exactly. Remember that single human astrocyte process interacting with up to 2 million synapses?
Mm-hmm.
Because it physically drapes over all of them, the astrocyte can mediate what is called heterosynaptic communication.
Heterosynaptic,
yeah.
Meaning across many different, entirely separate synapses simultaneously.
Exactly. Instead of just coupling neuron A to neuron B, the astrocyte acts as a master hub that couples thousands or millions of different neural connections together.
Wow.
When you introduce a computational node that complex, your memory storage capacity no longer scales linearly. It scales superlinearly or exponentially.
Exponentially.
Yes. By acting as a shared, highly connected variable across millions of synapses, the astrocyte provides the dense, high-order connections that allow a biological network to hold an astronomically larger amount of associative data than a neural network ever could on its own.
Okay, I want to try an analogy here to help visualize this difference. Think about the components of your computer. Neurons are like the RAM, the random access memory.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. RAM is lightning fast. It processes the immediate present, the keystrokes you're making right now. But RAM is incredibly volatile. The moment the power drops, the data in the RAM is completely gone. Neurons are the RAM.
And the astrocyte.
Astrocytes are the massive hard drive. They operate slower, but they store intricate, complex data patterns in their stable calcium waves and chemical states. And when you need to recall a memory, the hard drive slowly drips that stored information back into the fast-firing RAM for you to actively process.
That is an incredibly helpful way to visualize the division of labor. And if we look at the biology of working memory, we can actually see this exact dynamic play out.
Working memory being like your ability to hold a two-factor authentication code in your head just long enough to type it into your laptop.
Exactly. For decades, scientists thought working memory was maintained by a continuous loop of neurons firing action potentials over and over again, keeping the electrical signal alive until you used it.
The RAM just frantically looping the data so it doesn't disappear.
Yes. But continuous firing requires a tremendous amount of energy. It turns out working memory is heavily driven by the astrocyte. When a stimulus happens, you see the code. The local astrocyte releases glutamate into the synapses.
Yeah.
This sudden wash of astrocytic glutamate increases the probability that those specific synapses will fire if prompted. It creates what researchers call a bisystable state. The synapse is physically primed, almost like a spring being loaded.
And because chemical changes take a lot longer to clear away than an electrical spark takes to fade.
Exactly. The astrocytic chemicals take seconds or even minutes to clear away. Because of this, the memory is held in an activity-silent state.
Activity-silent.
The neurons can completely stop firing. They go quiet, saving huge amounts of energy. But the memory isn't lost. It's safely held in the physical, chemical, calcium state of the astrocyte. When you need the code a few seconds later, the primed synapse allows the neurons to instantly snap back into the correct firing pattern.
That handles the short-term working memory beautifully. But what about the deep archives? What about long-term memory? How does the hard drive permanently store data from, say, our childhood?
That brings us to the fascinating concept of astrocyte engrams. In neuroscience, an engram is the physical trace of a memory in the brain tissue.
We used to think engrams were just neural wiring, right?
Exclusively neural wiring. But recent research shows that the act of learning physically and genetically alters the astrocytes themselves. When an animal learns a new task, specific populations of astrocytes in the memory centers actually express a gene called CFOS.
CFOS is an immediate early gene, right?
Yeah.
A marker that the cell is actively changing its fundamental structure.
Yes, it indicates high cellular activity and structural remodeling. The learning event causes these astrocytes to upregulate their adrenergic receptors, specifically ADRB1.
So they're physically remodeling their own surface.
They are literally writing the data to their hard drive. They become more sensitive to future signals.
And how is that data stabilized so it lasts for years?
When you recall that memory later, those specific genetically altered astrocytes trigger the release of a specialized protein called IGF-BP2. This protein acts like a chemical fixative. It stabilizes the memory trace, cementing it into the network for the long term.
That is wild.
It gets even more sci-fi than that. Scientists have identified these specific groups of modified cells and named them learning-associated astrocyte ensembles, or LAAs.
Okay, LAAs.
In lab experiments, researchers have found that if they artificially activate these specific LAAs, they can force an animal to recall a specific long-term memory and perform the associated behavior, even if there are absolutely no environmental cues around to trigger it.
So the physical memory trace fundamentally lives within the architecture of the astrocyte network.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've scaled up from a single tiny synapse to the massive networks of astrocytes managing our memory. Now, we have to tackle the ultimate question, the biggest mystery in all of biology, and arguably philosophy.
Consciousness.
Yes. How do all of these incredibly localized memories, these discrete sensory influences, combine to create your seamless everyday experience of being a conscious entity?
This brings us to a major philosophical and neurological hurdle known as the disunity of consciousness.
Disunity.
Right. To understand why consciousness is such a hard problem for the neuron doctrine, think about what happens when you look at an apple.
Okay.
The visual cortex at the very back of your brain processes the color red. A completely different geographic area processes the round shape. Another area retrieves the long-term memory of what it tastes like. And if someone says the word, the auditory cortex on the side of your brain processes the sound.
So this information is entirely parcelated, broken up, and distributed across dozens of different regions.
Not only is it geographically separated, but those different regions process their specific sensory data at slightly different speeds. Visual processing timing is different from auditory processing timing.
But that completely contradicts my lived experience. When I look at an apple, I don't feel a delay. I don't see a red blob, wait a few milliseconds, see a round outline, wait again, and then hear the word.
Of course not.
I just experience the object apple as a unified, seamless, fully integrated, three-dimensional reality in the present moment. I experience a unified consciousness.
And that unity is the problem. Despite decades of intense searching, neuroscientists have never found a single keystone neuron or a central anatomical hub where all these fragmented signals finally come together.
There's no little screen in your head.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There is no central processing unit. The neuronal networks are too fragmented, too discrete, and too reliant on point-to-point wiring to bind all this disparate sensory information together simultaneously across the entire brain.
So how does it happen?
This massive gap in explanatory power is the heart of the Astroglia syncytial theory of consciousness, which was prominently proposed by Dr. James Robertson.
The Astroglia syncytium. Okay, let's unpack that term because it sounds incredibly dense. What exactly is a syncytium in biology?
A syncytium is a mass of biological tissue where the individual cells are not entirely physically separate from one another. Instead, their outer membranes fuse in certain places and their internal cytoplasms are actually connected.
Oh, wow.
This allows them to share internal fluids, ions, and electrical charges directly, allowing millions of cells to function together as a single continuous entity. Astrocytes in the neocortex do exactly this. They are physically interconnected by structures called gap junctions.
And what's a gap junction made of?
They're tiny pores formed by specific proteins called connexins. These connexin pores link the inside of one astrocyte directly to the inside of its neighbor. And because every astrocyte is linked to its neighbors, this creates a massive, contiguous global web of astrocytic tissue stretching throughout the entire gray matter.
Wait, so instead of thinking of billions of individual isolated astrocytes floating around, we should be visualizing one giant, brain-wide, highly connected superastrocyte.
Functionally speaking, yes. The entire network acts as a single functional unit, and this massive syncytial structure has a very unique physical property. It is isoelectric.
Isoelectric, meaning?
It means there is minimal electrical impedance across the network. If an electrical charge enters one side, it can propagate across the network with very little resistance.
Wait, I need to pause you there. Because I thought we spent the whole first section of this deep dive establishing that astrocytes use slow chemical calcium waves and neurons use fast electricity. Now we're saying this astrocyte web has fast electrical signaling too.
They actually utilize both. That's the brilliance of their design. They use the slow chemical calcium waves in their local microdomains to manage individual synapses and store memory. But the massive syncytium itself, the global web, can pass electrical currents globally at incredibly high speeds.
So why didn't we know about this?
For decades, scientists simply couldn't measure the electrical properties of this astrocytic web because the loud, chaotic electrical spikes of the neurons constantly drowned it out. It was like trying to hear a whisper in a crowded stadium. But recently, researchers developed techniques to temporarily silence that neuronal interference. And when they did, they proved that electrical conductance within the Astroglia syncytium is just as rapid as it is in neural networks.
So you have a single continuous physical web spanning the entire brain,
yeah,
capable of transmitting electrical signals instantly.
Yes. This rapid global electrical capability allows the Astralis Insidium to gather local synaptic data from the visual cortex, the auditory cortex, the memory centers, and transmit that unified state globally across the entire brain in tens to hundreds of milliseconds.
Which happens to be the exact time frame required for a human being to form a conscious thought.
Precisely. The Syncytium physically binds the diverse sensory streams together. Because it's a physically unified web, it provides the spatial and temporal unity our conscious experience demands. The neurons provide the discrete data points, but the astrocyte web is the canvas where the picture is actually painted.
But wait, the gray matter isn't the whole brain. We have two distinct hemispheres, the left brain and the right brain, and they're separated by a huge valley filled with white matter. How does the Syncytium bridge that gap to ensure my left and right brain are part of the same consciousness?
That's where the theory expands into the panglial syncytium. The network doesn't stop at the edge of the gray matter. Astrocytes also connect via those same gap junctions to a different type of glial cell called oligodendrocytes.
Those are the cells that produce the myelin sheath, right? The insulation for the neural wires.
Exactly. Through these connections, the glia form rapid syncytial bridges straight across the corpus callosum, the bundle of fibers connecting the two hemispheres. This panglial network allows for the instantaneous integration of the left and right hemispheres, unifying both sides into a single, cohesive, conscious ego.
Think about the philosopher William James. Over a century ago, he noted the paradox that there's no single center of the brain. There's no pontifical cell where the soul sits and watches the sensory data. What we're seeing here is that the center isn't a specific geographic place. The center is this invisible, vast, connected web of glial cells that touches every single part of the brain simultaneously. The web itself is the center.
It is the ultimate biological integrator. The neurons gather the raw data from the outside world. The Astralis Insidium is the continuous space where the experience actually happens.
Wow. Okay, so in science, to really prove that a specific system runs the machine, you have to look at what happens when that specific system breaks down. Let's examine pathology, because our sources argue aggressively that astrocyte dysfunction is the true root cause of major neurodegenerative and psychiatric diseases. Let's start with Alzheimer's disease.
For almost the entire history of Alzheimer's research, the disease has been viewed through a strictly neurocentric lens. It was viewed as a neuronal death issue. The theory was that amyloid plaques and tau tangles build up, choke the neurons, and the death of those neurons causes the dementia.
But a really groundbreaking 2026 study flipped this entirely.
It did. Researchers looked at the cells in the cortex, exhibiting signs of premature aging and cellular senescence. They found that nearly 80% of the aging failing cells in the Alzheimer's brain were actually astrocytes.
80%, so it's fundamentally an astrocyte disease first, long before the neurons start dying in mass.
That is the emerging consensus. These senescent astrocytes basically stop doing their jobs. They stop providing that massive metabolic support. They stop regulating the synapses with D-serine. And worse, they become reactive and pro-inflammatory.
Actively harming the environment.
Yes. The study found this astrocytic failure is especially prevalent in people carrying the APOE4 gene, which is the most significant genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's.
So how does the progression look from the astrocytes' perspective?
In Alzheimer's, astrocytes exhibit a biphasic trajectory. In the early stages, long before severe symptoms appear, the astrocytes become hypermetabolic. They work extreme overtime, burning massive amounts of energy to clear the plaques and protect the circuits.
But eventually they burn out.
Exactly. They enter the second phase, becoming hypometabolic. They shut down. And once that massive support infrastructure collapses, the fragile neurons quickly die off, leading to severe cognitive decline.
Which perfectly explains why decades of clinical trials targeting the neurons,
right,
just trying to clear away plaques to save neurons, have been so frustrating and unsuccessful. We've been desperately trying to fix the sales team while the whole corporate building collapses.
Exactly. It also brings up the concept of cognitive reserve. We all know stories of people whose brains are riddled with Alzheimer's plaques when autopsied, yet they showed almost no signs of dementia while alive. Why do some people resist the pathology better?
Right. Why is that?
It appears cognitive reserve is heavily mediated by the robustness of these astrocytic networks, specifically noradrenaline receptors on astrocytes, particularly in the frontoparietal region of the right hemisphere. If a person has a highly developed astrocytic network there, the syncytium acts as a massive compensatory buffer.
Wow, so it reroutes the signals.
It dynamically reroutes signals, adjusts synaptic weights, and maintains cognitive function, adapting to the pathology and keeping the mind coherent even when physical damage is occurring to the neurons.
And the sources also discuss schizophrenia in this exact same context. If Alzheimer's is a failure of astrocytic metabolic support and memory storage, how does a glial failure lead to schizophrenia?
The current cutting-edge model views schizophrenia as a fundamental failure of the tripartite synapse. If the astrocytic receptors at the synapse fail, meaning the astrocyte can no longer properly sense glutamate or release D-serine, it loses its ability to regulate the flow of information. This leads to what researchers call unconstrained synaptic information flux.
Let me use the club analogy again. This means the bouncer has completely abandoned the door, the velvet ropes are knocked over, and the club is pure chaos. Everyone is shouting at once.
And if we look at what that chaos does to the mind, it explains the symptoms perfectly. The brain relies on the astrocyte for contextual gating, the ability to filter out irrelevant background noise and focus on what matters. When the astrocytic gate fails, the brain loses its ability to filter signals and form coherent cognitive representations. The conscious mind is suddenly flooded with a torrent of unintegrated, chaotic sensory information and spontaneous neural firing,
which manifests clinically as hallucinations, delusions, disordered thoughts.
Exactly.
Which brings us to a massive realization. For a century, we've poured billions of dollars into trying to cure brain diseases by strictly targeting the neurons. And we have largely failed to find a true cure.
This raises an incredibly important question for the future of medicine. If the astrocytes are the primary computational units, the memory hubs, and the integrators of consciousness, then the true potential for healing lies in targeting the other brain, the glia.
Taking care of your brain health fundamentally means taking care of these vital metabolic managers. It's about keeping your vast web of astrocytes healthy. Let's quickly recap the sheer scale of the journey we've just been on. We started by realizing that the electrical neurons we've worshipped for a century are only 15% of the story.
And that our tools blinded us to the chemical language of the glia.
Right. We looked into our evolutionary past to see how cosmic events drove the need for massive human astrocytes, which are vastly larger and infinitely more complex than a rodent's. We saw how single astrocytes act as the literal bosses of millions of local synapses,
dictating behavioral states.
And we discovered that dense associative memory architectures rely on astrocytes to act as the brain's massive hard drive. And finally, we explored the awe-inspiring idea that the physical isoelectric web of the astroglia syncytium is the continuous canvas that weaves together our conscious reality.
All of which leaves us with a final, highly provocative thought to ponder as we move into the future. If dense associative memory, contextual gating, and the instantaneous binding of human consciousness are fundamentally reliant on the continuous biological syncytium of human astrocytes, what does that mean for our current pursuit of artificial intelligence?
Oh, wow. That is a massive pivot. Let's explore that.
Think about modern AI. The large language models revolutionizing our world right now are built purely on artificial neural networks. They're complex mathematical models meticulously designed to mimic the fast, point-to-point, discrete electrical signaling of the neuron doctrine.
They're built entirely on the 15% model.
Precisely. We are building our most advanced intelligence engines based on a century-old biological dogma that we now know is vastly incomplete.
Wow.
If true cognition, massive superlinear memory capacity, and perhaps the very spark of consciousness itself actually require the slow, state-dependent, highly interconnected physical web of an astrocyte network, will a purely neurocentric AI ever truly achieve human-like consciousness? Or is it mathematically doomed to just be an incredibly fast calculator because it is entirely missing the most important part of the biological blueprint?
That is a staggering thought to end on. Are we desperately trying to build an artificial mind using an obsolete, incomplete model of the brain? Are we just building the flashing lights of the city, perfectly simulating the traffic, but completely forgetting to build the massive silent infrastructure that actually gives the city a soul? I want you to keep exploring the hidden universe inside your own head. The next time you think about your mind, look past the bright flashing lights and take a moment to marvel at the magnificent dark infrastructure doing the real work. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.